Today is June the 22nd. Vera Hickman interviewing Margaret Blair. When we finished our last tape, you had just moved to Baltimore.
Oh, yes, I remember. And I think I'd gotten a job in Washington, D.C. as a statistical typist with the WPA administration. And I had to get up about 6 o'clock every morning, get to the train station. I don't remember whether I had to take a cab, and then the train to Washington, and then a cab to work. This all came to about double what the vet leave were paying. Anyway, I'm not a very good typist, but I guess I did it all right. And I'd get home from work, and then usually work on the newspaper that Blair was putting out in Baltimore. This was the ISU rank and file, because the old Marine Workers Industrial Union had decided that it was better to go into the larger union, which was not radical, and to be with, that was the correct thing to do. So we were putting out this rank and file paper. And the main fight in Baltimore at that time was against this Warner gang. I think I already mentioned that. And one night, this good friend of Blair's came in on a ship. His name was Harry Hines. He was an Australian, and he had been the first leader of the Marine Workers Industrial Union. He went around with my husband to bars and restaurants where the seamen were hanging around. Anyway, they got quite a gang of the rank and file, and they were able to chase the Warner gang out of town. So that was the main accomplishment there. And actually, we were only in Baltimore about 5 months, as I remember. He went back to New York because he figured they probably weren't looking for him any longer. And so I got him to go into the longshore work. He had been the organizer of the barge unit before, but so much was happening with the longshoremen, they thought that was more important, so he did that, and I went back to a WPA job. Now, I'd just like to say, for the next 3 years, about, I had, was on 4 different WPA projects, and all of them did really very good work. They talk about these jobs just being make work, but they were very, I mean, they weren't, what's the job for
that? I think that's the educated consensus.
Yeah. The first job was, I was a teacher of remedial reading at a grade school in Harlem. That was, we got back there in the spring, and then when school was out, I got transferred to another job, which I believe was working with this psychoanalyst, Margaret Fries. She had this program. Well, I'll explain a minute how a lot of these projects work. People that wanted to do certain research work would apply. It's like applying for a grant. They would apply to the WPA and explain how many people they needed, clerks, psychologists, what have you, and how much money about it would take and the length of time that their particular...
In other words, a grant proposal.
Yeah. That's the way it was handled. Anyway, this woman had a... she was a psychoanalyst on the side, and we had lectures from her about once a week, and the rest of the time, she had this program going where she was following newborn babies, and all of us took turns sitting in the hospital watching this newborn baby after it was born. The parents didn't know anything about this, but we had to write down everything every time they turned over or sneezed or whatever happened to them, and we would take them into the mother. They probably thought we were working for the hospital, I don't know.
We knew
where they had to be fed and so forth. And she had devised this machine called a moral machine. A moral is a reflex that babies have when they're born. Their foot curls up like a fist making a hand. And this only lasts for a few months. Well, her idea was that if she registered the length of morals that the different babies had, we had a stat watch so that we could measure the length of the moral, and then that she would follow them years later and find if there was any relationship between the length of this reflex and the way the person adjusted to society. So she had this machine with two weights that you would drop down at the once. You had to put the baby in the center, and the weights went down on each side and scared the baby to death if they'd go into the moral. Yes. So that's what that was, but I began getting disillusioned with psychoanalysis. She had this theory. She was a follower of Jung, who was quite similar to Freud. Anyway, she was so convinced of her theory that she made her patients fit the theory rather than seeing what happened and being objective and observing. To give you an example, she was talking to us one time. We were watching babies that were a little bit older, and she said, now that baby, one baby was knocking two blocks together, and she said, now that shows that that baby has been sleeping in the same room as the parents and has seen the parents having intercourse. And that's what the knocking the blocks together meant. Well, this baby wasn't even a year old. It seemed so ridiculous, but she already knew the situation in the home and that it was the same room, but she just fit her ideas into this. And this project, I don't remember how long it lasted, but then the next job, when the funds had run out, or
That was the end of her experiment.
Yes, she figured, I guess, that she had the record of enough babies that she would follow them up later. Yes, so then my next job was a sex delinquency project. And that was run by Judge Cross, quite a famous woman judge in New York City. And we had these cases of young, wayward minor girls. These were young girls who were becoming prostitutes. So we would give them tests, and intelligence tests and achievement tests, I guess, and make a recommendation to the judge.
And of course we would. What kind of a recommendation?
Well,
you mean whether they should be probation or?
Yes, we would say that if we were. Actually, we would just give her the results of the test, I think. Yeah. We might recommend a little bit, maybe, about the home situation. Anyway, we studied the case record on all of these people. Also, she took us into the courthouse, and we would see the women that were getting arrested and the policemen testifying against them. And there were probably about 30 of us in that. Anyway, on all these projects, well, I might as well go to the last project, too. Then when that was finished, I worked in a psychiatric clinic in a Harlem school for problem children. And we gave them tests. There were a lot of these children had just come up from the South. You know, things were terrible in the South, just like they were in New York, that they would expect it. The parents would expect to get jobs in New York. And so we would test the children. I remember then, I mean, I was never afraid of going into Harlem, and I would go out, I would have meals with a couple of the black girls in there. That was one thing that the psychiatrist couldn't understand, is why I went out to meals with these two black employees. Anyway, on all of these projects, I think I was organizing them into a union. The union was the American Federation, I'll have to think of that later.
Right. I'd like to go back to
State, County, and the Municipal Bodies. Right. I think, but you'd like to go back to
Judge Cross. what did she hope to discover here, or was this helping them with this, some sort of therapeutic experiment? I mean, your interview with these young women.
Yeah, she was trying. Now, for instance, now you hear a lot about abuse of children. Well, a lot of these young prostitutes had been molested by somebody in the family, and she was trying to study how. Was it economic conditions that forced them into
or
this kind of
molestation?
Yes, all these various things. And most of, and you know, at that time, the middle of the 30s, this was 1936, 37, around mm-hmm. that period, economic conditions were very, very bad, and a lot of girls would just get fed up at home. And
that would be their only way and economic
yeah,
survival.
Yeah. yeah.
Did you ever hear any of the conclusions that she reached?
No, I didn't.
No, I didn't. But the molestation was a very common
yes,
thing.
Yes.
We all knew that. I mean, it's interesting nowadays.
Yes.
All this
nonsense. Well, you know, I never thought, but I mean, I was molested when I was about 7 years old.
Yeah.
Oh, I think I mentioned that before.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But this is very common.
Yes, it was common.
I thought it was very
we all knew about it
when it happened to me. Anyway, so my life consisted of, frankly, I looked upon the jobs. I thought I was a pretty conscientious worker, and I found it interesting, but I really wasn't interested in having a career. The only thing I was interested in was changing the system. And that's when I began feeling I wasn't going to keep up with the psychology end of it, that, you know, even if you were turned out to be a good psychologist or psychoanalyst, which I really didn't believe in, you might just help a little person here and there, but that was a drop in the bucket. My theory was that what we had to do was change the system
yes.
and the environment, and then there would be hope of really accomplishing something. So I would organize the projects we were on, everybody would join, you could talk to people so easily because having been unemployed and being on WPA, they were beginning to think, and we had terrific demonstrations in New York, marching up Fifth Avenue, you know, on various occasions. And I remember once we had a demonstration, we came to support disabled workers that were on WPA, and the cops were there on horses beating up the disabled workers, people on crutches and so forth, and their horses, running around with their horses against them. I mean, it was really sickening. And, of course, I was still going down to the docks and working on a paper. Now I was working on a paper called The Shape-Up, and because my husband was involved in one of the other docks, I guess we were putting out the two papers, because my little group put out the hook, and this was the deep water docks, the paper of theirs was called The Shape-Up, and our paper was the coastwise shipping. That means just going from one port
mm-hmm,
in the United
mm-hmm,
States to the
mm-hmm,
other,
mm-hmm,
mostly on the east coast.
Yeah.
yeah. And so this continued for about three years. You see, the reason that they put a lot of importance on this work and that they had middle-class people going down to the docks was that the line of the party at that time was to concentrate on the working class and get more workers in. And the idea was that working-class people were much more important than people with middle-class backgrounds. So I was very glad to assume the responsibility, I would have the job and keep us going, and my husband would be an organizer. He usually got about $5 a week, and on WPA I was getting $23.86 a week. And in fact, later on, on WPA we worked to get prevailing wages so that I only had to work 3 days a week, about 6 hours a day. So that was really
what were prevailing wages?
The prevailing wage. Well, that was to get my $23.86. They cut the hours down.
I see.
You can figure it out. I won't take time now. $23.86 for 3 days a week is 6 hours. That's 18 hours.
Yeah,
right?
Okay.
So you can divide it and find out what the prevailing wage for a psychologist was. That's what I was raised as. So, then, in the long show work, they were getting quite a few hundred to rank and file meetings, and John L. Lewis then decided to help, along and Harry Bridges, they gave money to work on the, try to get the longshoremen in the ILA sign pledge cards to join this new union that was going to be the same as the ILWU on the West Coast.
Now, what is the ILA again?
ILA is International Longshoremen Association.
Okay.
That is the gangster union. Well, some stool pigeon got in and stole a lot of the pledge cards, and actually the campaign flopped. And, but it was still going a little bit when this friend who was in charge of longshore work asked me, said that they needed someone on the West Coast and to go to San Pedro and organize this Browder meeting. And so my sister and her husband happened to just be back from the Soviet Union, where he had gotten a job as a chemist.
How long had they been there?
They had been there 2 years then, and they were going on vacation. They were there 3 years altogether.
But they had come home for a vacation.
Yeah, they were driving across the country, so I went with them. My husband couldn't get released from the
part
of work he was doing, but he put in an application, and in a few months he would be able to join me. So anyway, I stopped in Spokane, and saw in the paper that these silver shirts were going to have a meeting, and I decided, well, this is terrible.
These were Nazis?
Well, they were called, yes, they were fascists. They didn't call themselves Nazis, but that's what they were. I mean, it was a real fascist organization, and the head of it, Kelly, I think was his name, was always talking about assassinating President Roosevelt. And so anyway, I went downtown in Spokane and looked for Workers' Alliance headquarters and found them and suggested that we have a picket line. And they agreed there hadn't been any picket lines or any sort of that activity since Wobbly's free speech fight back in 1909. Anyway, we organized a picket line, men and women, and friends of the family, and of my family, and some of them went inside while we stayed out picketing.
And what were they?
They were curious just to see.
In front of some building or something?
It was in a hall they were having a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So, actually, it was obvious that the policemen didn't want to arrest us, but they wanted to arrest some of the people that were very active at that time in the unemployed movement. So, they arrested some of these men. And
which men?
That were on the picket line.
I see.
That
okay.
were active. The head of the Workers' Alliance and various people that were very active there. And it looked like they weren't going to arrest us, so he said, well, they tried to get us to disperse. But then we said, no, if they're guilty, we're guilty. So they arrested us, too. And so we just spent the night in jail, and we noticed in the women's section that there was very unsanitary method of drinking water. I can't remember what it was. But anyway, we raised Cain about that, and they did put in drinking fountains, I think, after that. Anyway, they improved that situation. And my father came to the jail that night. He wanted to see about bail. And I told him, well, I don't want you to put up bail unless you can get bail for all of us. And which he couldn't do. Finally, we did get out because the railroad workers put up some bail. That was Spokane was the center of the railroads at that time. So that it was quite a center of the IWWs before that period when the IWWs were active. Anyway, when they realized, some newspaper man, I guess, realized that they had elected somebody from sort of a well-known family, he came up to the house to interview me, and I think I gave you the interview. Anyway, they had said that we were going to use some communist lawyer from Seattle. This was on the radio all the time. It was in the middle of the summer, and there wasn't much doing in Spokane, so we really got a lot of...
You weren't going to have a trial.
But we hadn't discussed what lawyer we were going to have or anything. And my family suggested a lawyer that they knew who was considered radical because he was for Roosevelt. He was a Democrat. So I called him up, and I went to see him and told him that we thought we had done our part in bringing the attention of the people to this fascist organization that was up to him to defend us free of charge. So he agreed to do that. And while I was there, he talked to the prosecuting attorney, and I could tell by the way he answered the prosecuting attorney, he practically said, well, they got to you first, you know, that the fascist group was working on the prosecuting attorney. Anyway, we went around to Coeur d'Alene, various places, soapboxing and making speeches and collecting a little money for our trial. And when it came time for the trial, which was just in less than 2 weeks, I was only in Spokane 2 weeks altogether, but it happened to get the news every day. So when the trial came along, I got this telephone call from the lawyer saying that it was agreed that the prosecuting attorney was going to drop charges, and that
would not be a trial.
The only thing, anyway, they had to appear in court, but he said all they were asking was that none of us appear in court. So I took it up with the group, and they agreed, well, if those are the circumstances, we'll go along with it. But I didn't just trust them, so I took my sister down with me to the courthouse. I sat out in the car, and she went inside. And the prosecuting attorney got up and said the charges were being dropped because our lawyer had assured him that we would never do it again. Well, this was a real sellout, so she came and told me, and I rushed in and told the newspaper man that that wasn't so, that if the Silver Share Cat was going to have a meeting the next day, we would be there again, and the DAR should be there with us. My mother happened to be a DAR, you see, so I was always dragging them into
it. I bet they love that.
And so the last day, I forgot to tell you, before that trial, we had a meeting to form an organization, the American League Against Foreign Fascism. And they billed me as the main speaker. Well, I had never done any public speaking, and I never had wanted to, but I was stuck, and it was getting to be near Labor Day, so I did a little research, and I talked on Labor Day. But the hall was full of Silver Shirts, Workers' Alliance people, the unemployed, you know, union people, DAR people, some of the teachers I'd had in high school, and some of the family friends. And when I was talking, these Silver Shirts, and one in particular, you know, he was
heckling?
Heckling, yes, heckling, and he was calling me names and this and that, and that so aggravated one of these old lobby members that at the end of the meeting, it seems they had a little fight and he threw him down the stairs. So the article the next day in the paper was "Peace Meeting Ends in Riot." You know, there was no riot
involved.
So. Anyway, from there, they also interviewed, they asked a few questions. Well, I think you'll see that there, of my brother-in-law about the Soviet Union. And they asked my father what he thought, and he said these young people have to fight for what they believe in. But it was really interesting. He had been deaf quite a while, you know, but he went to, whenever we had a meeting downtown in the streets in his place, he would go and stand in the front and hold his ear to get every word possible, and listening over the radio all the time. He was really getting a kick out of it. And my mother, she didn't ever say anything, either pro or against. She just had to go to bed a few days, and a lot of her friends were calling up wanting to come over. I guess they wanted to take a look at her freakish daughter. Anyway, I didn't get invited to come and visit very soon after that, as I remember. But I went on down to San Pedro. And
yeah, well, your sister, did she go with you, or did she?
No, they went back. They went back to the Soviet Union.
Oh, they went back. That's
yes. They went back for another year.
Right.
He had a job at his company had sent him to put in a certain process there, and in fact, he found that they had changed. There was still sabotage going on then. They had changed the formula. Somebody had. And if that hurt his ego, I know, and he really traced it down and found out who it was. And
someone in USSR?
Huh?
Someone in
USSR? Yeah, someone in the factory had changed his formula.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it didn't work,
mm-hmm.
you see.
Mm-hmm.
But he found that he found out where it had been changed and
mm-hmm.
why it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And it was corrected, and that person was... got into trouble, I don't know. I mean, I never knew any more about it. That's just one thing. Anyway, so I was down in Pedro, and we had quite a successful meeting for Earl Browder at that time in the Wilmington Bowl. We had a lot of waterfront workers, marine workers, and steel workers.
Was this a rally, sort of, or?
Well, yes, it was a... You know, in New York, we had had meetings of, the largest, what would you call them? Well, with thousands and thousands of people, and every seat taken,
mm-hmm.
just thousands.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of the places in New York, but...
Large
meetings. Well, this was large for this area, and
mm-hmm.
this, you know, little... group of people in San Pedro.
Mm-hmm.
But then in a couple of months, when I first got there, I decided, well, I'd better get in some factory and do a little organizing. So I did get a job in a tomato factory.
Processing tomatoes?
Canning, yes. So I was put right where they come out of the steam, and we had to take the skins off and drop them in the cans, and we put a little sprig of mint in. Well, by the end of the day, my hands were all blistered.
And the steam?
Yes, because the new people were just given the worst job, and I was given a hairnet and a knife, and, you know, I think that was... Yeah, now I was there 8 hours. Oh, my husband happened to arrive. Well, he wasn't my husband yet then either. But anyway,
Blair arrived,
and I had just been at work the one day, and I was so exhausted. He made me quit that job, and I don't know why I agreed so easily, but I did.
Well, probably because your hands were blistered.
So I went back to get my pay, and for the 8 hours, how much do you think it was? I got a check for 76 cents. Now, what had happened, it was supposed to be 25 cents an hour, but there was something wrong with the machine, and you would stand there, and the machine would break down, and they, with a stopwatch, they checked you out, and then when they get it going again, they checked you in again. And this went on all
night
long.
You weren't paid when the machine wasn't working.
And then they deducted for the hair net and the use of the knife. So I had a check for 76 cents, which I should have framed. You know, I should have kept
it. Yes, you should have.
We needed
the money.
So that was the end of my factory
experience in San Pedro.
Yes. And but while we were there, some very interesting things happened. We did organize a big picket line against the Japanese ships bringing, taking the scrap iron out.
Okay, we'll continue that on the other side.
Okay.
We're almost. I didn't want it to be interrupted because we're practically at the end of the
thing. Oh, I see. Well, you don't have to.